that he has this spiritual readiness, and he had worked on himself to get rid of the sins and committing different kinds of major, minor sins. And he reached to this merit of meeting Imam Ali Salam in person. And this is a really great tawfiq.
Exactly.
And for those who had this chance, this is not an easy thing to happen, I mean, overnight.
Sure.
I mean, but it requires lots of work and ourselves. That is, man arafa nafsa faqad arafa rabba. That if we work on our soul and our nafs, then the ma'rifa and knowledge of Allah will be also possible for us. So this is one aspect. The second kind of meeting or having a relation with Imam is a heart contact of Imam. That is, some people see Imam alayhi salam, and they cannot talk, they cannot say anything, they just see, but they have a sort of heart contact with Imam alayhi salam. It happened even at the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The way that Uwais al-Qarani, I mean the status and relation of the Holy Prophet and him. The Prophet entered the masjid and said, I'm tasting the smell of Uwais, is he here? But he left already. And you see that the Prophet actually explains and describes Uwais in the very beautiful way, while he hadn't met him even for a single moment.
Yeah.
So how does it happen? This is sort of relation specifically belonging to infallible and companions and followers and those who are with him.
May Allah hasten his reappearance and bless us with the love of Imam and with his contact and his members in our heart. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
Last week, the second edition of the Paris meeting took place in the French capital, attended by representatives from Zionist Israel, the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, with the aim of solidifying the negotiating framework that will guide the indirect negotiations between the Palestinian resistance Hamas and the Israeli entity. However, after the Israeli entity signed backtracked from what was agreed upon in Paris previously under the direction and pressure of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who prevented his negotiating team from returning to Cairo to continue the talks and had stripped them of their powers, delegating his special advisor instead. This made it clear that no one can trust the commitment of the occupation even to what it and the mediators would agree upon in Paris too. Moreover, it is evident that the U.S. administration exerted strong pressure on the Israeli regime, specifically on Netanyahu, to push for the meeting and attempt to reach a deal in the coming weeks. Americans and other mediators are striving to finalize an exchange agreement and a temporary ceasefire before the onset of the holy month of Ramadan in about 2 weeks. They believe that the continued fighting during the fasting month, along with the anticipated restrictions imposed on Palestinians in the West Bank and the occupied territories regarding access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, would constitute the perfect recipe for significant and comprehensive escalation within occupied Palestine as a whole and even in the region, given that the holy month of Ramadan has typically witnessed clear security escalations in recent years. It has now become clear that the Israeli occupation seeks to close the file of captives in order to resume its field operations, relieved from the pressure of this issue, which burdens the Israeli entity decision maker and does not grant him wide maneuvering margins, whether in combat or at the negotiating table. However, on the other hand, Hamas realizes that this issue is one of the most influential factors on the Israeli entity leadership and its performance in the war, which means that Hamas will not rush to abandon it unless what it gets in return is no less than an agreement on a ceasefire. However, Netanyahu remains adamant against any formula that includes a long-term truce or a temporary cessation of hostilities for long months, as it seems that he has not yet made a real decision whether or not to invade Rafah. In related context, Egyptian sources informed the Wall Street Journal that Hamas is ready to agree to the Israeli occupation's release of 3,000 Palestinian detainees during the exchange deal. But the Zionist soldiers' captives will remain with the Palestinian resistance until a permanent agreement is reached for a comprehensive ceasefire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. It seems that the decision regarding the Rafah operation is still pending, not only due to field-related reasons, as the attack on Rafah requires different and more complicated preparations than what happened in other areas, but also because the situation there is contingent upon the positions of other parties in the war, whether they are partners to Zionist Israel or maybe mediators who at this stage refuse any attack on the city of Rafah and prefer a negotiated path to end the fighting, albeit under different names, through a relatively improved prisoner swap deal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, political analyst and lawyer, expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Omar. Now, as talks are underway in Paris, and possibly as Reuters said the other day that they might continue in Qatar, does the Israeli regime really seek to maybe end his captives file where the pressure would be released from there and then continue his military campaign inside of Gaza with more intensity? Or is it really a very tense situation internally for Netanyahu that the Zionist entity has to be pushed into stopping this aggression, this genocidal aggression against Gaza?
Yes, well, now for more than 140 days, the genocide in Gaza is ongoing. The Israeli army has been killing people constantly since more than 140 days, using more than 60,000 tons of explosives and bombs thrown at an area that is not much larger than 360 square kilometers, where 2 million people are squeezed in this area. And now they're squeezed even more in a 50 square kilometer zone near Rafah, near the Egyptian border, where the Netanyahu and the Israelis are threatening, and they are bombing. They are bombing Rafah. Last night they bombed Rafah, they killed. Every day they're killing around 100, 150 civilians in the Rafah area. They want to do a full invasion there. And, well, they're using this in the negotiations. And that's so unethical. You know, you don't go to negotiations and threaten people, threaten civilians with massacres in order to improve the conditions in the negotiations. This is a total outrage. I mean, this is what Netanyahu's government has been doing. They've been putting on the table, you know, they want to win time, so they want to delay these negotiations as much as possible while they spill the blood of innocent civilians in Rafah and continue to destroy every possible means of life in Gaza and in Rafah more specifically now. This is outrageous. I mean, the negotiations were supposed to be over four different areas. First, the exchange of the prisoners. Mm-hmm. Second, the ceasefire, cessation of hostilities and bombing of civilian infrastructure, civilian hospitals, everything that has to do with life in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And fourth, the removal, the withdrawal of the Israeli army from the northern part and from parts of Gaza so people can return home. You know, and there is no way that the Palestinians will accept that the Israelis create buffer zones. In fact, the Americans said that they will not accept the buffer zone issue. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is the return of the people to their homes and the start of the reconstruction. Where is all that in the negotiations? They only want the hostages, the prisoner exchange. For the prisoner exchange, okay, the Palestinians were ready to actually offer, saying, okay, fine, we will accept. We will accept to discuss the actual swap of one Israeli to 10 10 Palestinians. However, there is no agreement over the names, because the Palestinians have in mind a list of names of people that Netanyahu is not ready to actually release and exchange. Mm-hmm. And that is also a serious obstacle.
This is what I want to discuss
with you. Biggest obstacle, I have to tell you, Marwa, the biggest obstacle is the issue of ceasefire and permanent ceasefire. Because every time there was a deal, and in the previous time when there was the exchange of prisoners, the Israelis intensified the bombardment and intensified the arrests of innocent Palestinians. So what is this exchange about? If every time we do the exchange, the Israeli army goes into the West Bank and in Gaza and arrests thousands
of people, definitely. But because I want to discuss with you the requests by the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, who said that they are ready to exchange the captives, the Israeli captives they have, with 3,000 Palestinian detainees from Israeli entity prisons. And they want to keep the soldier captives with them in order to ensure that the ceasefire will happen. Now, whether or not this happens, that's not what we want to discuss. In the event it actually happens, let's say it does actually happen, what kind of proof does the Palestinian side have that the Zionist entity won't just start a new unforeseeable attack against residents' areas in Gaza?
Now, the massacre and the genocide, the Israeli genocide in Gaza has been going on now for more than 5 months. So let's go back to the beginning, when Hamas actually, from the beginning, and there's nothing new, they said all of the prisoners for all of the prisoners, a swapping deal. That was the offer. The Israelis refused this offer. Okay, so we went to the exchange of the actual civilians and people who were guests, as Hamas called them, and there was this exchange, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and there was this operation in the past. Today, what Hamas is saying, okay, there is on the table a proposition that a ratio of 1 to 10, one Israeli for every 10, but that only applies for 35 of the prisoners, not of the 135. Mm-hmm. If there would be a general deal for the full number of prisoners, I think that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have said before that they are ready for this exchange. Mm-hmm. All of the prisoners in the Israeli concentration camps and prisons, mm-hmm. for all of the prisoners that are the captives of Hamas, mm-hmm. and the resistance and the Islamic Jihad. That could be a deal. But what guarantees? Of course, there are no guarantees.
Definitely.
There are no guarantees. But if Hamas gets this deal, it's a big victory. It's an important victory. But the Israelis should know that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad did this proposal from the beginning. It is Netanyahu who made them go more into war and do more bloodshed and more massacres and more destruction and more complicating issues and complicating any path towards the minimum agreement that would stop this genocide.
Definitely, because
to
be honest with you, Dr. Nashebe, the Zionist entity propaganda concerning the grand invasion of Rafah has been severe for the past month at least, but especially for the past 2 weeks. But let's say Netanyahu actually achieves what he wants from any upcoming peace talk or any upcoming negotiating talk, let's say, an agreement that might see the withdrawal of the captives of the Zionist entity from the...
But excuse me to interrupt you. I have to say that I think that the media, the Israeli media, and the talk about Rafah is blackmailing. It's to blackmail the Americans.
But
and the
issue,
community.
You say it's to blackmail the Americans, but if what Netanyahu wants happens, will he suffice with what he has done so far in Gaza, or has the decision to invade Rafah been taken?
I think that Netanyahu has the whole will to actually destroy what's left and kill what's left of the innocent civilians that are trapped in Rafah. However, and he knows that the Americans don't want him to do that, so he keeps talking about this in order to blackmail and to put more pressure on the international community and find justifications. And he thinks, and he said it, in fact, he said that the more we threaten with blood, the blood of children and the blood of... and that would improve the actual stance of the Israelis on the negotiating table, as we said in the beginning. And that's completely unethical and unacceptable in any negotiation process. You don't threaten with the blood of women and children and hospitals in order to improve the conditions in the negotiations. Mm-hmm. That is completely against international humanitarian law.
Mm-hmm. Well, within the norms that is happening right now and within the history that we know the Zionist entity, Dr. Nashebe, no one really trusts the Zionist entity, and apparently not even their allies trust them anymore. But I want to really thank you very much for being with us this morning in Beirut. Dr. Amar Nashebe, political analyst and lawyer expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which you can find published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, and I do advise you to follow because it's a really very important supplement. Thank you, Dr. Nashebe, for being with us. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about Yemen, how they are adamant, Yemenis are adamant on supporting the people of Palestine, and they will not stop until the Zionist entity stops its genocidal war on Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The naval forces of Sana'a continue to flexibly execute their operations in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf of Aden, while they persist in surprising the American and British navies. Following each operation that threatens the American and British vessels, the latter navies deploy swarms of drones and warplanes to patrol the international waters to protect the vessels and destroyers from Yemeni drone attacks, then carry out attacks on areas that have been already targeted before, meaning they have no real targets there. More details in the following report.
Events and developments are rapidly unfolding at the levels of direct confrontation between Yemen on one side and the United States and its allies and proxy armies on the other. U.S. and British Navy are intentionally concealing many facts about the almost daily operations carried out by the Yemeni naval forces against their ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden in support of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Although the U.S. Fifth Fleet, based in Bahrain, recently acknowledged the difficulty of confronting the Yemeni side, it did not address the strikes that targeted American ships and destroyers. Conversely, military experts in Sana'a affirm that there are escalating military operations against American and British military ships and warships. This reality has become evident to the United States, which has acknowledged facing its biggest challenge since World War II. With 7,000 American soldiers at sea experiencing fatigue and exhaustion after more than 4 months of confrontation without adequate rest or leave, they were caught off guard by the military capabilities of Sana'a, including its large stockpile of missiles and drones with advanced features capable of bypassing major defense systems and reaching the closest level in the defense system, as reported by the Financial Times, citing Lisa Franchetti, the commander of the U.S. Navy. Recently, Admiral Brad Cooper, the deputy commander of the U.S. Navy in the Middle East, admitted in an interview to CBS's 60 Minutes that their forces in the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea are operating at a combat tempo unseen since World War II. He stated that their military ships are under attack with only 9 to 15 seconds to decide to intercept missiles traveling at speeds of up to 3,000 miles per hour, acknowledging the military superiority of Yemen. Second Truth confirming the unprecedented quagmire for the United States and a highly costly war of attrition is Cooper's admission of the U.S. Navy launching about 100 missiles from its standard land-to-air missiles, each costing about $4 million U.S. dollars, against Yemeni missiles or drones worth only thousands of dollars. This means that the United States of America spent nearly $500 million on the cost of intercepting missiles alone, not to mention the cost of airstrikes and Tomahawk missiles launched at Yemeni land, operational expenses for about 7,000 American fighters, surveillance, reconnaissance, and satellite costs with zero results, as underscored by Sayyid Abdulmalik Badreddin al-Houthi in his speech last week. Meanwhile, Yemeni strategic operations continue to escalate significantly, effectively, and tangibly breaking the backbone of of the Israeli entity economy, and it seems it won't cease as long as the Palestinian blood continues to flow and tears of children and women continue to shed. It is a commitment that has been affirmed by the Yemeni leadership, and they will continue to adhere to it until the Israeli entity genocidal war stops and water, food, and medicine are delivered to Gaza.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist and political analyst. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, after its failure at the Red Sea, we see that Washington has resorted to classifying the Yemeni resistance movement Ansarullah as a terrorist entity, only to realize that such classification is just futile. It's nonsense. Ansarullah possess no assets or financial exchanges, neither in Washington or any other capital in the Atlantic, for that matter. Additionally, Sana'a is not inclined to retreat from its support that it has already declared as the operations in support of the people of Gaza. But what is next right now on the U.S. agenda concerning this issue in dealing with this unprecedented threat that they are facing in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf of Aden?
Greetings to you. Regarding the United States, there is a quasi-paralysis in dealing with what it perceives as threats directed at it and its allies by Ansarullah, especially since the beginning of this confrontation that has been going on since 2015, when Saudi Arabia declared what it called Operation Decisive Storm to change the reality in Yemen, much like Netanyahu attempting to change reality in Gaza. However, in Yemen, they dealt with a force that was a big surprise to them, after 9 years of continuous aggression and blockade. Today, we have a version of Ansarullah that runs a state with its security, social, economic, and cultural apparatuses, and conducts a real strategic supporting war in the Red Sea and the Arabian Gulf, imposing a serious blockade on the Israeli occupation entity and preventing ships from heading towards its ports. This is the result of 10 years of Saudi-supported American and British aggression and blockade. Today, the United States opted to designate the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization, as it had previously classified it years ago, but then retracted. Today, they resort to the same defeated tools, just as their targeting of the Yemeni people themselves within Yemeni territory indicates that they have no clear objective, because these are the same targets that Emirati and Saudi warplanes targeted over 9 years of war on Yemen. Through our experience in understanding how Ansarullah deals with reality, we have found that Ansarullah does not deviate from the policies it adopts and does not calculate political considerations like neighboring countries do, or like mercenary movements in what was called the Arab Spring, which were characterized by rushing towards private interests instead of paying attention to national interests and the interests of the nation as a whole. For example, Ansarullah did not use the Red Sea card throughout the years of the Saudi-American war on it. But today, it only uses it in support of the Palestinian cause, which is a fundamental principle of the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni government in general.
Mr. Hamza, we did hear the Admiral Brad Cooper. He admitted, as you just said, that the U.S. forces in the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Aden, in the Arabian Sea, they are operating at what he said, and I quote, at a combat tempo unseen since World War II. One might listen to that and think, well, haven't the U.S. had any wars since then? But yes, they did, but they haven't had this kind of resistance maybe since then. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces say that they are just using their old stockpile. They are not even using their new weapons yet. They are keeping that full power for maybe later. But how close is this confrontation to maybe an all-out explosion, not only in the Red Sea, but in the entire Arabian Peninsula?
The Yemeni armed forces have linked the operations in the Red Sea to what the Israeli occupation entity is doing in Gaza. They have stated that their operations are in support of the Palestinian people and resistance. Therefore, the cessation of operations is directly linked to halting aggression on Gaza and lifting the siege on the Palestinian people. Another condition was later added, which is when the Americans, along with the British, launched aggression on Yemen to try to alleviate pressure on the Israeli occupation entity and attempt to impose U.S. hegemony and control over the world through the Red Sea. Another condition was added, which is the cessation of American aggression on Yemen. And linking the level of Yemeni escalation to the level of American aggression on Yemen. As we saw last week, the Yemeni attack with ballistic missiles and drones in a manner that the Americans are not used to in an area where Washington has long considered itself the decision maker and dominant force. And this is the advantage the Yemenis have today, that they openly and aggressively confront the United States. This is because the 9 years of Saudi Emirati aggression on Yemen have prepared the Yemenis themselves and their missile arsenal, naval mines, and unmanned aerial weapons for a battle suitable for the geographical nature and nature of this enemy.
But there's another kind of threat that we have seen the U.S. and British intelligence use in Syria, for example, or in Lebanon, for that matter, is the security apparatus threats, which were issued by the Yemeni Minister of Interior and the Intelligence Security Agency, which revealed them thwarting a very malicious scheme sponsored by the United States of America and written to mobilize terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS from Al-Baida to carry out assassinations and bombing campaigns in residential areas in Sana'a and other several provinces as well. Would you think that would be enough to alleviate maybe the pressure on the Yemeni naval operations in the Red Sea, make them stop or at least push it to halt at least its operations in support of Gaza?
In the recent period, we witnessed how the Saudis, Emiratis, Americans, and the broad coalition formed to fight Yemen have tried all recipes to break Yemen, from assassinations and massacres to mobilizing Takfiri groups similar to what happened in Iraq and Syria in most of Yemen's provinces. They even funded and continue to fund separatist movements calling for the separation of southern Yemen from the north and eastern Yemen from the west. And speaking of new regions such as Hadramaut, where separatists have long demanded independence from Yemen. All these attempts were aimed at inciting discord in Yemen, in addition to the actual places that the United States, Britain, and even the Israeli occupation entity occupy strategically in Yemeni islands and areas. But all these attempts were defeated by the Yemenis. And today, we see the urgent need to complete the liberation operations to expel the occupying forces from Yemeni territory. Today, there is talk of a different scenario, which is the rehabilitation of mercenaries in southern Yemen and what the United States calls the legitimate forces affiliated with the Aden government. These mercenaries are supposed to occupy the coastal strip, which includes many ports and areas overlooking the seas, with heavy air support from the British and Americans. Perhaps they will try, through these mercenaries, to wage a proxy battle, because they fully realize that their current battle has no horizon, unless they make a big decision to launch a ground operation in an attempt to eliminate the capabilities of the Yemeni armed forces. However, the Americans and the British will not be able to achieve their goals and persuade Ansar Allah to stop its operations in the Red Sea to support Palestine. Therefore, the plan to occupy the coastal strip is, for the Americans, the optimal plan to strip Ansar Allah of their areas of strength that bring them some financial returns.
But they fail to understand, maybe, Mr. Hamza, that even those in the south of Yemen actually agree with the operations being done by Ansar Allah in support of the people of Gaza, because the Western world still doesn't understand that Palestine is a very central cause for all of Arabs, not only for Ansar Allah in Yemen, all of Arabs, including the Yemenis who are in the southern part, who had a big problem with the Ansar Allah movement over the past 9 years. But I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist and political analyst, for joining us from Beirut. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. And ladies and gents, thank you. Please stay tuned every week for more updates from here, the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
We are with you. What about you? Meaningful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
From the point of view of the Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution. The right to vote and the right to determine one's fate are among the fundamental rights highlighted in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Basically, people's rights are pivotal issues emphasized in political systems of many countries. Chapter 3 of Iran's Constitution, 2, is about the rights of the nation. A variety of rights of people and their social freedoms and their boundaries are mentioned in this chapter. Stay with us to review the rights and freedoms clarified in this chapter. The rights named in Chapter 3 of Iran's constitution are as follows. The right of equality before the law for all regardless of their skin color, race and language. Equal support for men and women to enjoy all human, political, economic and cultural rights while observing Islamic codes. The right to enjoy judicial security and immunity. Prevention of torture, banning of desecration and harassment. The right of freedom of expression, writing and press within the boundaries mentioned in Islam. The right to enjoy group freedom such as formation of parties, political and vocational associations and holding of rallies. The right of intellectual and ideological freedoms and banning of inquisition. The right to choose your job, the right to enjoy social security, the right to enjoy free education, the right to have a house in proportion with one's needs, the right to choose place of residence, the right to a lawsuit, to refer to qualified court, and choosing a lawyer. The Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran has specified political principles, structures, hierarchies, status, and boundaries of government while determining the rights of citizens. This constitution has cast a special look at the right to elect and determine officials and national fate. According to Article 6 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the affairs of the country are run relying on public votes. This article stresses that people's participation in is practiced via elections or referendums, including election of the president, members of the majlis or the parliament, and city and village councils. Accordingly, the system of elections in Iran, the two key officials of the Islamic Republic, namely the leader of the Islamic Revolution and the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, are elected with people's direct and indirect votes respectively. The Islamic Council Assembly or the Majlis and the Assembly of Experts are also formed by direct votes of the people. The Majlis is almost the same as Parliament in many countries, while the Assembly of Experts, which has a term of 8 years, has the duty of supervising the performance of the leader of the Islamic Revolution and appointment of a new one in the case of need. According to Article 107 of Iran's constitution, the determination of the leader is the duty of the Assembly of Experts. In view of this, The members of the Assembly of Experts consult about all jurisprudence, whose qualifications are accepted according to Article 5 and 109, and choose the best one fitting with the qualifications. Article 111 of the Constitution mentions supervision on leadership as another duty of the Assembly of Experts. Accordingly, this body continuously supervises the leader's performance in various spheres. It is explicated that whenever the leader fails to fulfill his duties or lacks one of the conditions for leadership, the Assembly of Experts dismisses him. Another manifestation of administration of the affairs of country by people is the aforementioned Majlis or Parliament. The Majlis is the lawmaking branch of power. The lawmakers are elected for 4 years by the Iranian people. Considering the role and status of people in administration of affairs of the country, according to Article 69 of Iran's constitution, the sessions of the Majlis should be public and the complete report of the debates should be published via official television and radio. Yet for security reasons in special circumstances, closed sessions of the parliament are held. The ratifications of closed sessions are valid only in the presence of the members of the Guardian Council, while they receive 3 to 4 of the votes of members. The reports and ratifications of these sessions are released to the public after removal of emergency conditions. Article 69 of Iran's constitution is in fact a protector of people's status in administration of the country's affairs. Accordingly, each and every one of the nation should be informed of the issues and ratifications of the debates of the Majlis in detail. Another duty of the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, is to approve or disapprove the ministers proposed by the president. The parliamentarians can also impeach the members of the cabinet. Article 86 of the Constitution reiterates that lawmakers are quite free to express their views and cannot be judicially prosecuted for what they say at the Parliament in the position of a lawmaker. This article implies that a legislator in the Islamic Republic of Iran is completely free to defend people's rights and national interests, and there is no judicial confinement for him or her. The Islamic Republic has just witnessed the presence of tens of millions of people in the 45th anniversary of the glorious victory of the Islamic Revolution. People proved in their celebrations on 11th of February that what they are committed to, the values and achievements of the revolution, in spite of all barriers and problems.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Din-i-l-Islami, din-i-l-Islami.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mamajad Hossein, this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to travelers based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, in the last episode near the end of the program, I asked you a question regarding the conditions for the four rakah prayers to become obligatorily shortened on the traveler. And you just stated or the first condition for it to become, like, to be met, in fact, we want to talk about the four rakah prayers to become obligatorily shortened, right, on a traveler. And you said that the distance traveled by an individual or a resident of a town or a city must come up to 8 farsakh, yes, which is roughly about 45 kilometers.
Sure.
So what are the other conditions, would you?
The second condition which I would like to briefly mention is that the intention to travel,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Yes.
The distance. There should be such an intention should exist in the first place. When you embark on a journey, you should have the intention in the back of your mind that you will travel a distance which is at least 45 kilometers. If you don't have this intention and you happen to cover this distance, you cannot break your fast because you did not have the intention. For example, you have lost something and you go out in search of it, but you think, okay, you will find it very much close to the city. You end up traveling the 8 farsakh. You cannot break your fast. That is it. On your way back home, if the distance is 45 kilometers, then you have to shorten your prayers on your way back home, okay? Because you are returning home, and the distance you have covered outward and not return outward is about 45 kilometers. So when you go out searching for something, you cannot break your fast.
Right.
Or you cannot shorten your prayers. But on your way back or return distance, the return distance is 45 kilometers, so you have to shorten your prayers.
So the second condition is intention, you
intention.
Said. But is it before embarking your trip, your travel, or you can do it in the middle?
Well, no. You can. You have to.
For example, travel the distance.
Yes.
And then you intend to be a traveler.
Okay, that's something. From the point where you intend, you have to start
calculating.
Uh-huh. Yes. Not from your home, because a lot of people. Okay, let's see. There are a lot of people who are under the impression that, okay, tomorrow we are going to travel, so we don't have to make niyyah for fasting. We should have breakfast and then and then go out. That's not okay. That's not permissible.
I see.
Because as long as you are in your hometown, you should make niyyah fasting. You cannot break it. But when you leave your city and you reach a point beyond which you are considered to be a traveler, then you can settle somewhere, break your fast. Or maybe shorten your prayers and then continue your journey.
Thank you very much for clearing up that misunderstanding that might happen to lots of people. Thank you, my dear listeners. In fact, we're going to continue our program after the break. Just stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to travelers based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javid, you were talking about the conditions. You stated and gave us two conditions for the four rak'ah prayers to become obligatory shortened on the traveler. What are the others?
Well, the third condition I should mention is the continuation of the intention. Okay, one must have the intention, serious intention to travel. If he hesitates, okay, he, for example, he started his journey and in the middle of the journey he hesitates as to whether he should continue his journey or not, or he changes his mind even and actually decides to even return home, so in this case he cannot actually shorten his prayers. And in the event that he prayed, performed his prayers, okay, shortened his prayers before changing his mind, before hesitating or entertaining any doubt. So if before changing his mind, he shortened his prayers, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that actually he has to repeat those prayers as a measure of obligatory precaution. Now, this is the third condition.
Yes.
And the fourth condition is that there should be no intention of interruption. Okay. For example, he should not intend to see his hometown again. For example, he goes out and says, okay, there's another hometown, or maybe the same hometown, he wants to just cross his hometown and go to another place. Such an intention should not be there. If he has such an intention to, for example, to cross his hometown or stay, for example, somewhere for 10 days and then continue, that is... that
the invalidator of the traveler, that's, basically.
That, yeah, of course, that is an that renders the intention invalid. Now, the fourth condition is that the journey be a lawful one. Okay, it is important that one embarks on a journey for a lawful purpose.
Now, the fifth condition.
Yeah, this is the fifth condition. Yes, yes. The purpose of the journey should be lawful. It should be legal. It should be allowable, and there should not be no intention of committing any haram action. Should be involved in it. For example, if one intends to go and kill someone, or let's say commit, God forbid, adultery or something like this. These are grave sins, okay?
Yes.
He cannot shorten his prayers, and he cannot break his fast as well. This is the fifth one. Then the sixth condition, of course, that the traveler should not be one of those people who is migrant. He's moving from one place to another place, like Bedouins.
Like a nomad.
Yeah, like nomads who are always on a journey, moving from one place. So these are not included.
What about chauffeurs and drivers?
Yeah, drivers, yes. And then, of course, the driver, you know, it's traveling is part of their profession, you know?
Yes.
And this is the seventh condition. The seventh condition is that the traveling should not be one's job.
Yes.
Such as a driver or a seller, or for example the captain of a ship or so on,
or pilot,
you know. Or maybe even a shepherd, I suppose, someone who is traveling. And then if I have time, I should finish it. Then reaching the point of tarakhus, okay, that's another condition.
This
we talked about.
Is the eighth condition?
It. Yeah, it is the eighth condition, okay?
And the last condition.
And the it's very important. I did say that one cannot break his fast unless he crosses the point, or one cannot shorten his prayers unless he crosses that point. And these are the conditions which must be fulfilled in order for a person to shorten his prayers.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Shabit. And thank you, my dear listeners, for joining your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to travelers based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei in this program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.